Last week, we reported on new developments in the sex abuse scandal in the Catholic Church. More than 6,000 pages of newly released documents show how church leaders went to great lengths to protect abusive priests, moving them from parish to parish, and doing all they could to preserve the image of the church. But unfortunately, sex abuse in religious institutions is nothing new. Improper behavior is often committed by the most trusted leaders of a religious community, its priests, ministers, rabbis, and imams. And the Zen Buddhist community is no different. In a minute, we're going to hear the story of Edo Shimano, a Zen priest who sexually harassed his female disciples for decades. But first, we want to make something clear. Just as there is nothing intrinsic to the belief system of, say, Catholicism that leads to abuse by priests, there is no teaching in Zen Buddhism that breeds abuse by Zen masters. Such behavior is, in fact, contrary to the teachings of both traditions. And now, our story. My guest is Mark Oppenheimer, a religion columnist for the New York Times. His new e-book is called The Zen Predator of the Upper East Side. Welcome to Interfaith Voices, Mark.
Thank you so much.
Now first, who was Edo Shimano?
Edo Shimano was a Japanese-born Zen abbot, teacher, monk, who came from Japan in the early 1960s to Hawaii and quickly moved to Manhattan after offending local sensibilities in Hawaii by the way he treated some women. He then spent the next four or even five decades in Manhattan presiding over something called the Zen Studies Society, which was the most prestigious Zen center in New York City, but where he continued to harass, grope, grab, and otherwise sexually exploit probably dozens of women. He's still alive. He's 83 years old, and at long last, it seems to be coming to an end, but we can never be sure.
And how did he come to set up his sangha, which I believe is the name for like a Buddhist congregation in Manhattan?
Yeah, a sangha is a Buddhist community. After being brought to Hawaii by a very devoted but naive student named Robert Aitken, who was a very famous American Buddhist who had learned about Zen as a prisoner of war in Japan, Shimano quickly was basically run out of town, and he showed up in Manhattan where he, through his charm and a bit of luck, was handed the keys to something called the Zen Studies Society, which had been founded by D.T. Suzuki, who was a Japanese popularizer of Zen who had taught at Columbia University. Suzuki had gone back to Japan, and the Zen Studies Society was more or less moribund. Shimano took it over and quickly attracted a lot of followers. As he tells the story, he just began walking up the island of Manhattan in his Buddhist robes, and people started saying, "What are you doing?" And he said, "I'm here to teach Zazen, which is Zen meditation." And they said, "Oh, could I come along?" This was 1960s New York. There was a lot of interest in Eastern spirituality, and he's a very charismatic man, so it wasn't too difficult for him.
And in your book, you tell the story of Daphna, who revealed her story about him in 2010. Can you describe what she did?
Sure. Well, the first thing to understand is that over the past half century, there have been numerous eruptions of scandal in the Zen Studies Society where women have stepped forward to say that they had been pressured into sex by Edo Shimano or otherwise mistreated by him sexually. And always it's been either swept under the rug or the society has nearly exploded and lost members, but somehow it has moved on and it's rebuilt by attracting new members who in the pre-internet days were often naive about what had come just before them. The institutional memory would be lost, and so new and naive congregants would join the sangha. This latest episode in 2010 was when a young filmmaker in New York, Daphna is not her real name, stood up at the Zen Studies Society monastery out in the Catskills. They have a second location out in the Catskills, and announced to a dinner of people, of 20 or 30 people, what had happened to her, which is that she'd been involved sexually with Edo Shimano for 2 years. And it was consensual, but she hated the secrecy that he forced upon her, and she wanted everybody to know. And she stood up and dropped this bombshell, and then Shimano – and Shimano was sitting right there. And then he eventually left the room. And afterwards, this leaked to the internet. Because so much was at last coming out on the internet and people from the past were putting two and two together with people from the present, his board eventually forced him out. But it was 40 years coming.
You mentioned that what she described was consensual, or she said it was consensual. And some people hearing that would think, well, is that abuse? What would you say to that?
So let's be clear about what Edo Shimano, and I should say several other Zen Buddhist teachers who came over from Japan also in the 1960s, did with women. It was everything from, in some cases, grabbing them, groping them, or kissing them without having obvious consent from the women, and then mocking them or ridiculing them or persisting even when the women declined, to telling women that their path to spiritual fulfillment came through sexual relations with him, to simply seducing women and then who were students. These are students of his studying Zen meditation with him, and then abandoning them, essentially, breaking up with them, sleeping with friends of theirs, basically treating them in caddish ways that we wouldn't expect of anyone, much less a Zen teacher. So by consensual, I only mean we're not talking about physical force on a woman who was trying to run away or flee. We're talking about, in the case of Daphne, someone who willingly had intercourse with him over a couple years. Nevertheless, there was almost always an abusive aspect. In this case, it was that he was her Zen teacher, and so he was taking advantage of that position to initiate the sexual relationship. And then also that he was demanding of her a level of secrecy that that kind of psychologically terrorized her. That is to say, he wanted her as a concubine, but not as a partner or a companion.
And as I read your book, all of a sudden I discovered Shimano was married. So what was the role of his wife in all of this? Did she know? And what did she do after revelations of impropriety became public?
It's quite clear from my reporting and on the say-so of everyone, although I should say she didn't return my outreach. I spoke to her lawyer and asked to speak to her, and I didn't get any calls back. It's quite clear that she knew all along what was going on. She knew exactly whom she was married to. And, you know, as a Japanese woman of a certain generation, she either had made her peace with it or simply didn't care at all. But one of the great defenses that some of Shimano's supporters mount of him is that, well, he comes from a different culture and this is okay in his culture. The problem with that – I mean, there's so many problems with that, right? But
yeah.
One very telling problem with that is that, of course, nobody informed the women whom he was leaving often in total shambles, right? Women whose lives he had shattered. I mean, a couple of them were probably institutionalized in a mental hospital back in Hawaii. No one informed these women that they were supposed to be operating according to his feudal Japanese model of gender relations. These were American women who oftentimes thought they had a boyfriend or a lover and that that would be okay. And they didn't realize the way that he was treating them, which was often as just another sexual conquest.
How did you find out about this story to begin with? Who tipped you off?
I don't remember exactly who tipped me off. In 2010, when Daphne, as I call her, stood up at the Catskills Monastery, Daibosatsu, as it's called, and dropped her bombshell, it very quickly leaked to the blog of Tricycle Magazine, which is the number one or one of the top two magazines in the Buddhist world. So it was on their website. Little pieces of it were. And then somebody tipped me off to that, and I began making phone calls, and very quickly it became apparent that this was a wide open secret in the Zen world, that Shimano's behavior toward women had been known for decades and that people had sort of been waiting since more or less the Johnson administration for the other shoe to drop.
For this to get to be public and people just
– Yeah. For this to get to be public, for him to finally be called out publicly, for women who had been mistreated, who had seen their Zen practice destroyed, who had lost family members over this, over relations with him, to find each other. It really took the internet because that's what allowed a community of people who felt damaged by his behavior to come together and to really exert pressure. The internet made it no longer feasible for his board, his tight, loyal core of supporters on his board of directors to paper this over.
Now let's talk just a little bit about Zen Buddhism itself. What's unique about this particular branch that's different from, say, the Dalai Lama's Tibetan Buddhism?
Right. Well, so most people you'll know today in America who identify as Buddhist, chances are they're interested in Tibetan Buddhism, and they got their interest either from Richard Gere or the Beastie Boys or Robert Thurman or one of the major popularizers of the Free Tibet movement and the Dalai Lama. This is a phenomenon of the past 20 years or so. If you go back before then, the major popularizers of Buddhism in America, sometimes they were not Zen, but they were very often Japanese Zen Buddhists. There's also a Korean and a Chinese Zen, but they were Japanese Zen Buddhists. Zen places a particularly high priority on meditation, and particularly meditation as learned and supported by a kind of guru-type master teacher in a community of people who also revere that guru-type master teacher. So you become very, very dependent on the building, the zendo, the meditation hall, the setting, the sangha or community, and the roshi, the teacher. It becomes unthinkable to do your practice without this particular support structure. So people are very, very reluctant to leave their teacher, even when they feel very abused or exploited, because to leave the teacher is, in a sense, as they perceive it, to leave their practice of Zen altogether.
And you say that all this made for an environment in which sexual abuse became endemic to American Zen. So can you connect the dots there for us? How so?
Well, you had four major teachers coming from Japan in the early to mid-1960s, and they went to Los Angeles, to San Francisco, to New York, and so forth. In every case, either the teacher himself or his immediate successor at that community was involved in a scandal of a sexual nature. If you look at maybe the three or four dozen most important Zen centers in the United States, from Minneapolis to Seattle to Los Angeles to New York, let's say three or four dozen, it seems safe to say that about a quarter of them have seen some sort of sexual scandal on the part of their teachers or their clergy. So while the numbers, the absolute numbers, are fairly low, because there just aren't that many Japanese style Zen Buddhists in the United States, as a percentage of the teaching class, it's certainly higher than you would find in Judaism or in the Roman Catholic Church. It's really quite astounding how many, as a percentage of the teachers, have been involved in sexual misdeeds.
Yeah. 25% is a huge percentage.
Let me say, first of all, that it's always been a minority of Zen teachers and Zen practitioners who have any sort of problem with sexual misbehavior. That's number one. Number two, I think that many contemporary Zen practitioners would say that they're emphasizing more and more the aspects of Buddhist tradition that talk about compassion, that talk about righteous behavior, right action, all of these ethical teachings that are there in Buddhism, but that some Zen teachers have spent less time on in the past few decades. The third thing we should acknowledge is that a lot of people are drawn to Zen because they think that meditation is a healthful practice. We now have this thing called the mindfulness movement, which again is working against stress, which draws very, very heavily on Zen Buddhism. So people are drawing many, many, many good things from it that shouldn't allow the tradition to be identified only with what we've talked about here today.
Now, let's come back to Edo Shimano. You argue that he's a true sociopath, and I'm wondering what evidence you have to support that claim.
Let me say, if I had it to do over again, I probably wouldn't have used that word, in part because it's a deeply contested word in psychology and neuroscience. The idea that there can be people who simply don't know right from wrong or are indifferent to it, who simply aren't moved by conscience at all, is a controversial one. And I don't mean to make a particular claim of that nature. What I can say is that he obviously has erected tremendous defenses against reckoning with the consequences of his actions. He seems entirely sincere when you interview him in his belief that those who are against him or who call him out are either insane or they're liars. Everywhere you turn, he has what seems to him like a coherent answer for why that particular person would say such dastardly things. I mean, in one case, he said, "Oh, well, you can't trust him. He's homosexual." I mean, to him, that's a failing of character as well. So it's anything except that it might actually be his behavior.
You argue that his reputation, while it's not widely known, was at least tacitly acknowledged among people who were close to him, and many women who came to study with him even knew about his habits. So why was he still attractive to these people?
So what you have to understand, right, is these are students who are looking for a great teacher. And what does a great teacher mean in Zen Buddhism? It means someone who can help teach you how to sit for 2 hours, sometimes 12 hours at a stretch, sometimes 12 or 14 hours a day for 7 days in a row without speaking, eating only 2 small meals a day, barely sleeping, just meditating on your thoughts, on your koan, on counting your breaths. What kind of person can teach you to do that? Well, very few people are themselves good at that, and even fewer are successful at teaching others to have that kind of ability. So if someone's good at that, which Edo Shimano is, then you may be willing to overlook a lot of things if you think he will get you to that place. And the thought is, if you get to that place successfully enough and you meditate enough, eventually you might have a kensho. A kensho is a kind of experience of ecstatic enlightenment. And you'll, in all sorts of religious traditions, people will talk about that kind of experience, although they won't always use that Japanese word. Well, if someone says Edo Shimano will get you to your kensho eventually, you might say, well, maybe the stories of his womanizing are a bit exaggerated, or maybe she was asking for it. People will talk themselves into all sorts of things if they think that that's the one person who can unlock the wisdom for them.
How did he get away with this behavior for so long?
A lot of men in the 1960s, 70s, and 80s felt that promiscuity with women was okay. There was an aspect of the sexual revolution that permitted this. People were less enlightened about the power dynamic in sexual relations. So that's number one. Number two, there was a kind of tragic way in which some women who were very keenly aware of the patriarchal aspect of Zen kept his secrets for him because they felt that to talk about what had been done to them or to their sisters would drive other women away from Zen. And so because they wanted Zen to exist in America and to succeed, they didn't want to be the ones to give it a bad reputation. So because then they felt it would be even more of a patriarchy. In other words, if they spoke up for themselves about the patriarchy, they would dissuade other women from coming to Zen. It would be even more all male, and that would further reinscribe the patriarchy. So it was this vicious cycle whereby nobody seemed to have a good reason to speak out. Instead of speaking out, they would just leave. But when they left, they often were very, very depressed for many years because they felt that they'd left their practice with them.
And of course, sadly, all of this sounds somehow familiar. So how does this kind of pattern of abuse compare to what we've seen in the Roman Catholic Church or the Orthodox Jewish community?
In the Roman Catholic Church and the Orthodox Jewish communities, you have a failure of the people at the top of the hierarchy to take action. When you see the way that Norman Lamb, the former chancellor of Yeshiva University, covered up for some of the alleged abusers on his staff, or the way that archbishops would in the United States for priests, that's a failure of the hierarchy. In Zen Buddhism, what you have is a failure of the laity. You have an absence of hierarchy. There is no one in power they can turn to and say, hey, could you get Shimano out of here? It's congregational, to use the American religious sociological term. Every congregation unto itself, every sangha unto itself. So you could speak out against Edo Shimano, but what good would it do? I mean, if you destroyed him, you would destroy Zen in Manhattan. And then you had to hope that some other teacher built up the kind of sangha he had. But that was your only choice. You couldn't have him moved out and have another teacher moved in the way, in the best of scenarios, you could in the Catholic Church.
I know Shimano is still alive. So what eventually has happened to him? Where is he now?
Shimano is still residing in the apparently quite nice apartment that is owned by the Zen Studies Society or by him. This is up in the air legally on the Upper East Side of New York. He still has some very wealthy supporters who I believe are giving him money. He still meets with some of his loyal students in places, community centers, living rooms around New York and in other cities as well. And the Zen Studies Society, his former institutional home with whom he's now in a lawsuit and a counter lawsuit, is apparently fallen on financial hard times because they've lost a lot of members and they've lost some of their wealthiest members who have stuck by him. So it could end up being the worst of times for all of them. I mean, he is not in the august, exalted position he once was. He's not seeing as many new students. He doesn't have an institutional home, even though he finds homes for a day here and a day there to meditate. And the society itself is a building without a strong leader. It does have a replacement for him, but it seems that she doesn't have anything like the following that he had at his height. So it's worked out badly, I think, for everyone concerned.
And so he has a woman who replaced him in the role.
There's a woman who replaced him in the role. She's known as Roko. That's her Dharma name, as his is Edo. And she, I think, is doing her best to hold the place together financially, to attract new members, to fight this lawsuit with the help of their lawyers. It's a tremendously difficult time. But that's one of the critiques against him, right, is not just that he exploited particular women, but that he rotted out the core of his own sangha, that he caused so many people to leave in disgust, that he created such an aura of mistrust that eventually it was bound to disintegrate, that healthy organizations or societies continue and they go on even if the initial charismatic leader leaves, whether in disgrace or because of death or because of retirement or senility or whatever. Because of his behavior, it seems that the Sangha may completely disintegrate after him. Mm-hmm. The culture was destroyed as well as his own reputation and of course, the lives of many women.
And what about Zen Buddhism in America generally? Is there an attempt to reform or to prevent this kind of abuse in the future?
Yes, there is. That's a great question. There are a number of strains of reform within American Zen. You'll hear terms like engaged Zen or ethical Zen, people who are trying to make Zen more gender equal, bring Western ideas of power dynamics, sexual relations, toleration, fairness, anti-hierarchicalism to American Zen. There's a great community of people organized in the community known as Buddhist Geeks who do it. There's writers like Jay Michelson whose recent book is Evolving Dharma. There's a lot of people who are trying to move Zen past its feudal Japanese past and its patriarchy and into a kind of Western and more what they would say is an enlightened mode. So that's very vibrant and, we'll see where it goes.
Mark Oppenheimer is a columnist for the New York Times, and he's the author of the e-book, The Zen Predator of the Upper East Side, and it's available on Amazon. Thank you so much for joining us today, Mark.
Thank you for having me.